persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. The devil beware. Stand by. Pastor Scheidbach, the brain is on the air. Is about to blow your mind.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse and your brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage.
Truth served here, flavored with delectable wit, succulent sagacity, luscious logic, a gourmet meal for the mind.
Okay, my friends, let's get into the horse race for the White House. In the first segment, I'll offer my overall impressions from the debate and give you my picks for the top five favorites. In the second, I'll zero in on Trump and let you know what I think about all that. Now, first off, in the interest of full disclosure, I did not watch the debate in real time. I was busy with appointments, and after all, in the end of the day, people are more important than politics. Happily, however, my wife frantically searched where I could watch all of the debate this morning in show prep, so I did not have to depend on what others said about it. I would be able to form my own assessment firsthand. Okay, let's roll. The first of what I think are six scheduled debates is behind us. And the question is, did the debate have any impact on your leanings? It did impact my perception significantly. It actually rearranged my list of the top five favorites. And that was interesting to me because, frankly, in the past, I've never seen a debate that significantly impacted me like this one did. Everybody's talking about how Trump trumped them. But after some closer examination, I think you'll see the duck in the Donald. Ever see that selective attention experiment called the invisible gorilla? You know, you're supposed to count the number of times the kids in white shirts pass a basketball. Meanwhile, a man in a gorilla outfit strolls in, faces the camera, beats on his chest, strolls out, and most people don't see the gorilla because they're so busy counting passes. You've got to learn how to see the gorilla standing in the room in spite of all the clever distractions used to hide him. And I believe that's the Donald. He throws out so many distractions people are not noticing, in this case, the duck in the Donald. All right, I'll get into that next segment. But you remember when O'Reilly pressed Trump to explain how exactly is he going to make Mexico build the wall? The closest he came to a clear answer was simply to say, Mexico will build the wall. And then the next nearest thing you can get from Trump out of what he said, that might lead one to think he does have some kind of plan, is in his implied threat to interfere with Mexico's trade agreements with America. But you have to surmise that from his rambling answer. It's not real clear, although maybe that's what he has in mind. First, general impressions of those who did better than I expected. I would have to say Huckabee impressed me far more than I thought that he would. His performance in this debate put him in my top five favorites, for example. And he wasn't there before. I think Carson did better than I expected he would. However, going into the debate, I learned that Carson is weak on the second, saying that he was in favor of restrictions on semi-automatics in urban areas, while he was okay with them with people having semi-automatics in rural areas. And that's nonsense. Urban areas, if you think about it, well, that's where semi-automatics are most needed for self-defense. Anyway, so he dropped out of my top five before the debate, that and on the immunization issue as well. And his performance, though better than I anticipated on foreign affairs, still was not stellar and certainly did not redeem him from exile. And Kasich impressed me more than I thought he would. Only in his case, so far as I'm concerned, he did not move up in his standing, same place he was at before, and that's dead last. I mean, even, I should say, with Christie. And finally, I think Rubio did much better than I anticipated that he would, and I've since discovered some clarification on his position regarding same-sex marriage that I found refreshing and encouraging, so he definitely has moved up into the top five list for me. Now, as for candidates that did more poorly than I expected, well, that would have to be Rand Paul. I don't know how to say it. I don't want to offend my Rand Paul supporters, but it seemed to me he was trying to come on as tough, and I should say he certainly did deliver some effective jabs at Trump. That buying and selling politicians thing, I thought that was a worthy point. But he just came across as petulant. You know, to me, he came across like a lightweight throwing blows at a heavyweight. Now, please keep in mind that I like Rand way better than I like Trump. But I'm sure Rand could have done much better. I mean, you know, in truth, if you think about it, Rand could out-Trump Trump in terms of his clear-headed, simple, common-sense take on a lot of the issues, in fact, all of them, and add to that the plus that he has a plan that's executable. Anyway, my problem with Rand has, for a long time, been my observation that his pragmatic inclinations sometimes makes him vulnerable to compromising on his common-sense proposals, which in turn sometimes has put him at odds with his own ideals. Nevertheless, he is brilliant and absolutely must be on the team of, well, whoever gets the nomination. What a lineup we have before us, my friends. I mean, whichever one of these guys gets the nom should staff his cabinet with choices from among these candidates. Now, so much for my general impressions. Now, for some particulars, one advantage I had viewing the debate after the fact by examining the video clips was that I could re-examine any particular segment as many times as I needed to and study carefully the candidates' answers. And I evaluated the candidates on two categories, presentation and then substance in their answers. I evaluated them on a scale of 1 to 10 in each category. Now, if they came across as presidential in their presentation, meaning that they didn't hem and haw, you know, they did not stumble all over themselves in their responses, they came across as sincere and believable. They maintained their composure in a dignified manner when provoked by a question especially, and did not equivocate in an apparent effort to look nice or make nice, but seemed to come across with authority and answer directly when provoked, you know, stuff like that. Well, they got a 10 from me. With regard to substance in their response, well, if they demonstrated knowledge of the topic and actually answered the question posed, and the answer was coherent, reasonable, and articulated clearly, well, they can get as much as an 8 from me, but they didn't get a 9 or a 10 unless I agreed with their position. All right, well, I'm the one doing the evaluating for my own purposes, okay? And I can't go over the entire debate and give you my scores and explain the rationale supporting them, although I'm sure that would be interesting to at least some of you. So this was simply to give you an idea, however, of how closely I studied the candidates. Now, as to why I'm not going to offer my take on the second-tier candidates, the simple answer is that I don't have the time. However, I will say that happily, Perry did not stumble this time, but held his own very well. And for all the talk about Carly, to me she simply does not come across to me as presidential in her presentation. And while I agree with most of what she said in substance, it did not, in my opinion, separate her in any significant way from all the others. Now, I would not look forward to the spectacle of what will almost certainly, or what would almost certainly become, the equivalent of a political catfight between Hillary and Carly. Overall, I think Cruz stands out as the most presidential in presentation, and whose answers, I believe, had the greatest amount of substance. Now, I know that many polls are saying it's Trump and then Cruz, and Trump is, in fact, the front runner. So, you know, he's the one we have to take a shot at, right? So I'm going to devote my time to a careful examination of the Donald, not because I want to derail his candidacy necessarily, but because I have sincere concerns about his, well, his sincerity, his electability, and what I perceive to be a lack of substance supporting the populist positions he is articulating so very well, by the way. And I'll get into it in the next segment. Now, I don't think Walker had an opportunity in this debate to really shine in this crowded venue. And maybe he's just playing it low-key, I don't know. But however, I did like almost all of his answers. Not real excited about his answer to the question about why he once supported a path to citizenship for illegals, but has now or since changed his view, saying he did it after he, quote, listened to the people, end quote, and tried to make a big point out of how everybody wants a politician that listens to the people. To a point, okay, but that does not sound like a principled decision. Rather, it sounds like a political one. But his answer to the foreign policy question was very strong. He nailed it. He demonstrated that he does have a clear understanding of the threat from Russia, ISIS, Iran, and the need to present steel to our enemies. I thought was a good point. I thought his presentation was at all times presidential, and his substance was strong in the main. And with his own record in Wisconsin, it's arguable that he has the strongest case for electability in the pack. Nevertheless, in terms of a presidential presentation and substance in his answers, and in terms of a well-thought-out plan for implementing his policies, I put Walker up there with Cruz, but I think Cruz edges him out. Cruz seems to be the stronger in both presidential presentation and substance in answers, especially when knowledge of the issues is taken into consideration. Cruz is flat-out smart and very well-informed. In my view, the next in line would be Huckabee. With Walker and Cruz, as you know, I began touting Walker as my favorite at the outset. But since then, I've come to favor Cruz, with Walker as a close second. In fact, I'd like to see these two team up. But before the debate, Huckabee was not even in my top five favorites. However, after the debate, He's number three as far as I'm concerned. Back when Huckabee first trotted out and onto the racetrack for the White House, you know, back in 08, he seemed to be a bit too much the politician and was inclined to ingratiate himself to voters as he tried to posture himself as a nice guy, you know, desirous to get along with everyone. But somewhere along the way, Huckabee has grown a spine and clarified his position on policies, too. I mean, he demonstrated some gravitas. Tends a little toward Jackson-esque rhetoric. I mean, I refer to things like, you know, Reagan said trust and verify, while Obama's all about trust and vilify. And some of that gets a little bit wearisome. Sounds neat, I guess. I think he could have been stronger there and in a few other spots. But anyway, his answer to the military preparedness question was a home run. And his stand on abortion is absolutely perfect. When he said he did not see, for example, how the military paying for transgender sex change operations makes America safer, I thought that was a huge and a very good response. Our military certainly is not supposed to be a laboratory for social experimentation. And his position on abortion, as I mentioned, was very good, along with everyone else at the table, by the way. But he articulated it particularly well. His call for the fair tax was, again, I tell you, he spoke with authority. He spoke with knowledge. He spoke with clarity. He looked presidential. And his answers were substantial. So I've got Cruz, Walker, Huckabee in the top three. In fourth place in my list of five favorites is Rand Paul. It's true that I'm disappointed in his performance in the debate. For example, occasionally, he failed to hear the question, it seemed. Either that or he was purposely avoiding answering it, which is unlike him, by the way. So I think he just didn't hear it right. He was tense, nervous, I don't know. He definitely missed Trump's point on Trump's explanation of where he is at now on the single-payer idea. I mean, you remember when he chided Trump as continuing to put forward the idea of single-payer? But Trump had just said he no longer held that position. But anyway, my apologies to all my Rand lovers, and I love him too, but he simply did not have a presidential presentation, in my opinion. Nevertheless, I am an admirer of his intellect, and he is on the right side of every important issue. But as you've heard me point out many times before, I have difficulty with his isolationism. I really do not think America can sit back and look the other way like Clinton did when Rwanda was in the throes of genocide. And I'm not saying Rand would do that, but his policies would suggest that he would be very reluctant to step in a situation like that. America must take leadership in the world in support of liberty and justice for all. Anyway, then comes Rubio. Now, he was not in my list of five favorites before the debate. In fact, I had him exiled out in the back quarter here. I mentioned earlier that coming into this debate, I was not enthusiastic about Rubio at all. I felt that he waffled on the same-sex marriage question. I remember when he was asked whether he believed homosexuality was a choice or did he accept the idea of a gay gene, and he said, quote, "I don't believe that your sexual preferences are a choice for the vast and enormous majority of people," end quote. What in the world does that mean? It is for some, but not for the vast majority? It's foolishness. And then he said, he went on to say, in fact, quote, "The bottom line is, I believe that sexual preference is something people are born with," end quote. So he, oh boy. Rubio continued by assuring American voters that he doesn't take a personal stand against homosexuals marrying one another. He said, quote, "It's not that I'm against gay marriage," end quote. Oh, you're not? However, Rubio reminded his audience that he supported state legislators making these decisions and not judges resolving that issue. He said, quote, "I believe the definition of the institution of marriage should be between one man and one woman," end quote. And that whole exchange, without going back and reexamining it, as we did a while back, was very disappointing to me. It sounded to me like he wanted to be on both sides of that issue. He was crawfishing like a typical politician. Now, this can come from ignorance on his part. The reason I'm inviting Rubio out of exile is his more recent comments about the threat the homosexual agenda, and especially the recent court ruling on same-sex marriage, is presenting to our religious liberties. So anyway, there you have it. As my beloved Dove would say, hold on through the break, my dear friends. I'll be right back, and I'll do my best to show you the duck and the Donald.
Pastor Scheidbach's been in Santa Maria since bumpers were chrome and phones were connected to the wall. Now, he iPhones, texts, tweets, and podcasts the brain massage to over 100,000 subscribers. His series on the Bible and Bill of Rights continues Sunday night at the Lighthouse. This Sunday at 6 p.m., he will address the amendments the framers used to build a wall of protection around the ideal that a man is innocent until he's proven liberal. Har, har, a little brain masseur humor there. But really, Innocent until proven guilty is one of the dearest American values and is protected by the Fifth through the Eighth Amendments. Sunday night, 6 p.m. at the Lighthouse. Oh, and don't forget, BYOF, bring your own fork for Emily's strawberry shortcake. All right, we'll supply the fork too. But come on out for some fun, food, and fellowship while we talk about our freedoms.
Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your mind.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse, your brain masseur, and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps in the church belfry arch, signaling the enemy is on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberties. Every poll I've looked at since the debate puts Trump at top and Cruz at second, and that's good because up till now it has been Trump at top and then Jeb. Personally, I think Jeb is a big government conservative, and his take on the immigration problem, you know, that he wants to turn it into an economic driver, and, you know, his insistence that he wants to create some kind of path to citizenship, earned citizenship, not amnesty, as he likes to put it, and that especially in view of recent miscarriage of justice that has occurred here in our county of Santa Barbara. Now, I live, as most of you know, in Santa Maria, California, in my semi-rural cow town. An illegal alien teamed up with another lowlife and entered into the home of a 64-year-old woman, where they raped her and killed her by bludgeoning her to death. Outrageous! But it gets even worse. This character who was here illegally. Yeah. You know, among those who sneaked across, along with Jeb's vast majority of illegals, whose crossing our border illegally was for them an act of love. His words, by the way. Anyway, this illegal alien was on probation for battery against a woman back in May of 2014. Can you believe this? And he did this while in possession of meth, on probation for assault and battery and possession. What? You know, he should have been deported. And it gets worse. This fella has been charged twice for violating his probation. In one case, he was possessing a concealed weapon, a knife, by the way. And in the other occasion, it was for possession of drugs, again. One of our fine Santa Barbara judges allowed the scumbag to enter a substance abuse center in Santa Maria in lieu of going to jail. And then it gets worse. Quote, according to county jail officials, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, declined to issue an immigration detainer that would have required local authorities to hold him for deportation, end quote. This illegal alien decided to join up with another demented and vile fellow to enter into the home of Marilyn Ferris, rape her, and then beat her to death with a hammer. I don't have time to go over the entire list of illegal aliens who have done this sort of thing, but because this leads into my examination of Trump, and what's driving his popularity, where I promise to show you the duck and the Donald, let's take a look at what he actually said and why. Donald Trump said, quote, they're sending you people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they're telling us what we're getting, end quote. Donald Trump. Now, did you know that 2,000 illegal aliens were deported from Texas over the last, I don't have the number here. I mean, the number of years. It says a few, so it might be five or so, but 2,000 illegal aliens deported from Texas after committing sex crimes. And then this, Mexico is the number one source of heroin right now into America, supplying 90% of the U.S. supply. And it's all coming in over the border, right along with all those people who come here committing what Jeb calls the love crime. You know, of illegally crossing our borders. Almost 1,000 children have been sexually assaulted by illegals in the last 3 years in Texas alone. Now, that does put a different twist on the idea of love crime now, doesn't it? But you don't know about any of this because the MSM, mostly stupid media, is too busy with Cecil, however they want to pronounce that, the lion, and Trump's statement that illegals coming across our border are bringing drugs and crime. It appeared to me that Fox was trying to maneuver Trump into a corner on the immigration question, but it appears they failed. They turned to the tender-hearted Kasich to challenge Trump on this immigration position. It seemed to me they hoped to get someone to take Trump on with this, but even sentimentalist Kasich with his St. Peter policy. You know, when you meet St. Peter, he won't be asking how small you shrunk the government by how many of the poor you helped. Oh, man, I wish I had time to show you how shallow and superficial that nonsense is, including the fact that if you bankrupt the nation with oversized government, well, you will very soon not have any more of the other people's money to confiscate on behalf of the poor. But back to the point. Even Kasich admitted that Trump had hit a nerve on this point and that he has raised a legitimate concern for this campaign. Now, of course, he talked about that we have different solutions, however, and so on. But they couldn't get Kasich to go after Trump on this. So let me begin by saying what I've said repeatedly. Trump is saying all the right things, and he's put at the forefront the issue that really is a very sensitive point right now in American politics. And let me offer them my first insight regarding the Donald. He's no dummy. Now, the two things that came out about Trump in the debate that I would encourage everyone to give a little more attention to, maybe a lot more attention to, are his acerbic statements about women and his manipulation of the legal system to rip off hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars from investors via the bankruptcy or the, what are called the chapter laws. Now, Megyn Kelly asked Trump about his penchant for making insulting comments about women, calling them, for example, fat pigs, slobs, and so forth. Now, to his credit, he did not balk at the question. Trump cleverly turned it into an opportunity to comment on political correctness. But my friends, making rude statements about women, calling them fat pigs, slobs, and disgusting animals, and saying to, I think it was one contestant on Celebrity Apprentice, that it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. I'm not even sure what his point was with that statement, but it suggests something vulgar, does it not? And at the very least, something very demeaning. But these things are not about political correctness, Mr. Trump. This is about being a gentleman and behaving with appropriate decorum and manners. Now, there are few who are more willing to make strong statements of denunciation and derision against some people. For example, those who murder babies in the womb or who engage in the unnatural, unhealthy, and perverted lifestyle of homosexuality than moi. But the truth is, I never engage in name-calling. And if I create a term of derision, it's on purpose. And purposely and carefully crafted upon defensible grounds, and never simply vulgar, and certainly never gratuitous. On the stage in the debate, for example, he referred to those politicians who refused to take action on illegal immigration as stupid, and he used that word several times. Now, if one uses such a word, he should make clear he's using it in a technical sense, not merely as a bullying name-calling tactic, as in when someone is stupefied or dazed and unable to think clearly, or when someone does something that demonstrates a willful ignorance or a foolish disregard for common sense. You know, now that I think about it, that is certainly the perfect word for the point Trump was making. But do you see the difference? In using it the way that I have here, and what he did, he was simply name-calling, something he does quite often. Bullies throw names at people they don't like, and there's a bit of the bully in Trump. Did you notice how close he came to actually threatening Megyn? Quote, "I've been very nice to you, although I could probably not be, based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that," end quote. I don't know what you thought about that, but do you see the difference between straight, even jugular vein rhetoric that gets to the point and is pointed, and being ungentlemanly, unkind, even cruel? So, first thing, there is a bit of the bully in Trump. And frankly, I've had enough bullying from the president alleged who's already there, you know what I mean, to last a lifetime. That might be entertaining, but do you want 4 or, God forbid, 8 years, 8 more years of that kind of thing? As for the use of bankruptcy laws to bilk investors out of millions, actually billions of dollars, you need to look closely at his response to this and think about what he's saying. First, he never offers that his reason for using the chapter laws was because of financial duress or because he was unable to meet obligations. He presents it as a tactical business maneuver. And as I remember it, when it occurred, it was just a smart financial move that served his interests at the expense of his investors. So that's problematic for me. If he took money from investors and agreed to terms and then reneged on those terms, manipulating laws to his advantage, that might be considered smart business by some. But it smacks of an Obama-style approach, manipulating law and using law to serve his personal interests at the expense of others, in this case, in the billions of dollars. Now, what does that say about his character? I mean, this is the man who has never asked God for forgiveness. Now, in fairness, he did reveal that he is Presbyterian, that he has participated in communion, and does so whenever he can, that he attends church, that he loves his church, and that he does believe in God. And it should be pointed out that his attitude toward personal error was that while he did not bring God into that, he said, quote unquote, he does acknowledge, at least, that he commits errors that need to be corrected, and his idea is to go on from there and to make it right as best he can. So, you know, we can say that he's not entirely without a moral compass, but that moral compass is pretty weak in finding a good true north signal. I have questions about someone who uses the chapter laws to avoid taking a loss in a business deal that went bad, as opposed to what those laws are actually intended for, to protect someone from being devastated by a financial reversal, leaving them unable to pay their debts. I need to move toward a conclusion here. Probably my greatest concern about Trump, beyond the tendency to sometimes be rude and behave like a bully, and this inclination to manipulate the system for personal gain, and the fact that others do is entirely irrelevant so far as I'm concerned. By the way, I don't find his position on abortion to be fundamentally principled. It appears to me to be personal and rests on purely anecdotal support. You know, a friend thought about aborting, didn't. The baby's wonderful. Ergo, I'm no longer pro-choice. Look, I welcome any to the pro-life fold. And however they get there, well, that's fine by me. But if a personal anecdote can turn him from pro-choice to pro-life, then can a future anecdote turn him back? I mean, the baby in the womb is a baby in the womb, or it is not. The only substantial basis for the pro-life position is that the baby in the womb is a baby in the womb. So allow me to conclude with what I believe is the greatest takeaway from this debate and the most encouraging thing I've seen develop in politics since I've been paying attention. Every one of these guys is unabashedly pro-life. Did you catch that? All of them. I remember when the pro-life position was not so popular among establishment gopers as it apparently is today. I remember when the gopers wanted to kick that issue to the curb and were embarrassed by it, who felt it was merely a divisive side issue that was a personal opinion sort of thing and should be left out of politics altogether. But my friends, did you hear what these men were saying on that point? We heard, I think it was at least three of these candidates make the clear statement that abortion is about killing a baby in the womb of its mother, and clearly stipulating the court was wrong in its 73 decision, that in fact the 5th and 14th Amendments protect the life of the baby in the womb as it protects the life of every other individual. I mean, the statements were strong, unequivocal, and unabashedly, unashamedly, totally out there swinging for the life of the babies in the womb. And that should be your takeaway from this debate. Our message has penetrated, and it is burrowing more and more deeply into the conscience of this nation. One said he believed future generations will look back on this period as a, I don't remember what word he used or exactly how he phrased it, I'm sorry, but something to the effect of a Holocaust or something. I mean, just as a horrible, dark time in our history of killing, murdering millions of babies. And so take heart, my dear friends, as we begin to close a dark chapter in the history of our country of murdering 53 millions of precious little babies for the convenience of those who worship the idol of covetousness. Bible thump alert, covetousness is the sin of idolatry, sacrificing their infants on the altar of their idol, covetousness. We begin another long, arduous struggle against same-sex marriage. In the early years, remember, they were able to bamboozle so many in this country with the distraction of pro-choice, but as the American people have become increasingly knowledgeable about abortion, they have begun to turn from it. And it's only because of ignorance concerning the real agenda of the gay rights movement and what that lifestyle is truly all about that they are able to sell it now. Let's take the lessons we've learned in the struggle against abortion and apply it to this current battle. And I think we can hope to see this thing turn around in a much shorter time. Speaking of time, I've run out of it. So I'm not going to get a chance to really explain what I mean by identifying the Duck and the Donald. But you remember old Donald Duck trailing behind Mickey Mouse shouting, "Donald Duck! Donald Duck!" A constant crying for attention and so on. Anyway, unfortunately, I'm not able to really develop that. So it's almost not fair to leave you with that because there's a whole lot more to it. I'm presenting my fifth message in a series called The Bible and the Bill of Rights. I'll be addressing the 5th through the 8th Amendments. These are the amendments that protect the ideal that a man is innocent until proven guilty. Now come Sunday night at 6 p.m. and join us afterwards for Emily's Strawberry Shortcake. I have lit the lamps in the church belfry arch, and now you call and let me know you see that they are on. Call 1-888-770-8000. That's 1-888-770-8000. And the drill is this. You say lights on if you agree with me, and lights off if you disagree with me. God bless you. God save America. And I'll see you in church.
How would you like to encounter God in 2015? Are you ready for a renewed experience of God with a fresh encounter this year? Or maybe you've never experienced God and He doesn't seem real to you. Get ready to encounter God and know that He is real.